I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Russian conceptual artist, political activist, and founder of the art collective Pussy Riot, Nadia Tolokonnikova. She's joined in conversation by writer and musician Sarah Marcus. And now, join Maggie Grabmeier on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Nadia Tolokonnikova and Sarah Marcus.
Artist and political activist Nadia Tolokonnikova is founder of the Russian art collective Pussy Riot, which has emerged as the world's most prominent activist art group. In 2012, Nadia was sentenced to 2 years imprisonment in a Siberian labor camp following an anti-Putin performance by Pussy Riot in Moscow. Since her release, she's remained a vocal advocate for worldwide social justice, speaking against corruption and injustice. Her protest actions include jumping over barbed wire, kissing police officers, giving guerrilla performances in crowded subway cars, and going on a hunger strike to protest the abuse of prisoners. Nadia's new book, Read and Riot, A Pussy Riot Guide to Activism, outlines her 10 rules for revolution, including things like, be a pirate, take back the joy, and make your government its pants. Pussy Riot's work is vitally important, especially today, in teaching us new ways to speak up against injustice and make political action exciting. Nadia is joined tonight by Riot Girl historian and activist Sarah Marcus. Sarah is the author of Girls to the Front, The True Story of the Riot Girl Revolution, a definitive history of the 90s punk feminist movement. So please give a warm welcome to Nadia Tolokonnikova and Sarah Marcus.
Hello, thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you for coming. At the time of your arrest and trial in 2012, I was at the time traveling around a fair bit talking about Riot Girl, and suddenly at my events, everybody was really excited to talk about Pussy Riot. Your feminist punk performance collective came as an indicator that the feminist punk aesthetics and politics of the American 1990s could be useful and even influential to people decades later and a half a world away. It was an encouraging reminder that when people set out to do something original, visionary, and prophetic, as the Riot Girls in the 90s had, the landscape of effects and after effects can never be fully accounted for in advance, let alone mapped out. You make something, you respond to your own time and place, and it travels in ways you never anticipated. And I think that's also plainly been true of the work that you've done over the past several years.
Hopefully.
In 2012, Americans looked at Pussy Riot and rallied to your defense. Your abominable treatment in the courts and in prison was, for many Americans, our first occasion for paying closer attention to the repressive conditions that held sway in Russia. And things have changed a little since 2012 here in the U.S., and so without paint, just a little, without painting overly broad equivalences between our two countries, it is safe to say that we now in the United States are living under an ultra-nationalist ruler with autocratic aspirations, however, who openly reveres your President Putin and seems... and respects.
So we're talking about autocrats.
We were.
Yes.
You know, real and aspiring. Yeah. And I was just going to say that while the we'll get into talking about prisons more as we talk, but while the injustice of our prison system here is generally more about the organized repression of black and brown people than it is about show trials for political dissidents, as in Russia, we are right now seeing a troubling rise in the demonization of activists, with feminist protesters being characterized as hired guns and angry mobs. So all of which to say that if Pussy Riot began by taking inspiration from U.S. feminists, I suspect that many of the people in this room tonight are here in hopes of taking some inspiration and insight from you. You and the people that you collaborate with have been opposing an unaccountable, cynical, truth-destroying strongman's regime for much longer than we have. And you surely have some insight, encouragement, and thoughts on strategy to offer, as well as just reflections on where the journey has led you so far. Anyway, much of this is contained in your galvanizing new book, Read and Riot, Pussy Riot Guide to Activism. And I suspect everyone here looks forward to discussing, and perhaps whoever's calling right now wants to be in on it too. We're looking forward to discussing it with you in person here. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you all for coming, and you.
So let's start toward the beginning of things. Your work wasn't widely known, especially not in the U.S., until your arrest for performing your punk prayer at the Cathedral of Christ the Savior in Moscow, which suddenly brought international attention to Pussy Riot. What do you think it was about that action that sparked so much love and support internationally and in the U.S.?
So my PR manager is Vladimir Putin in this way. You know, I don't have a good answer to this question, but we discussed it obviously between us because we're not the first, and we're unfortunately not the last political prisoners in Russia. But aside from Khodorkovsky, who definitely got as much attention as we got, the oligarch. I think, unfortunately, people didn't pay that much attention to political prisoners in Russia. But it brought us to a conclusion that maybe the deal is in art. And that's my general advice. So now knowing people are asking me here in America, like, what's up, what should we do? I think that the answer is art, and that's the reason why our message resonated in people all across the world, especially in Western world, because you don't have to know Russian language in order to understand what are we doing, because you know, the picture of girls with feminist flag on the red square surrounded by all this phallic cathedral things, you know, like it's pretty straightforward. Or, you know, our punk prayer in church, like where when we're doing these kicks with our legs, and then the investigator would come to us and say, look, I can see your underwear. Do you think it's okay that I can see your underwear? And Masha was really pissed at the investigator trying to just embarrass her with asking about it. So at the time, I had no idea how to speak in English. Like, I learned English later. But, you know, I think when you use the language of art, you don't really have to speak in other languages. So it's like, you know, apostles of Christ. They learned many languages, but in fact, maybe they learned just one language, and it was art. I'm not comparing ourselves with apostles, because it was a thing, and during our court trial, we would quote Christ and Solzhenitsyn and Dostoevsky, and then you know, people who were opposing us, they're like, do they really just compare themselves with Socrates? Mm-hmm. No, they're just quoting.
Uh-huh. Right, but this is actually something that's so striking throughout your new book, is that you're constantly placing your thoughts and your art in conversation with thinkers from ancient Greece to up through Foucault, up through contemporary Russian dissidents, and in fact, Russian dissidents and political prisoners of, it seems, the whole 20th and even late 19th century. Is there a way that pressing politics through art enables you to connect with history in a different way than just, you know, going to a meeting or registering voters would do? And does it place you more in touch with the past?
I think it's just two completely different paths. And so, you know, they wrote here, joyfully resist. And I honestly, like, I somehow let it happen, this joyfully resist, because I it's not what I meant exactly. I meant not joyfully, but resist in a way that it's natural for you. And so by doing that, it will bring you joy, but it can bring you suffering, it can bring you pain, but it will bring you internal, like, joy on the deep level, not like joyfully resist, like party or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But like do it in a way that it's just natural part of you. Mm-hmm. So in this sense, I just hate, like, for example, I hate doing phone calls. So I would never do this kind of thing, like calling your officials, because I have phone phobia. And I don't think, like, those people who have phone phobia have to break themselves and, like, do it, because you can find another way which is more natural to you, and it's just more natural to me to do art. And about past, I think it just comes from my childhood, because I was growing up nerd in Siberia. And if you look up Norilsk on Google, Norilsk, it is one of the northernest town on Earth and one of the most polluted. So when you leave there, you don't really have option to walk around, play soccer, hang out with your friends. You just sit in your room and read books. Or you have another option. You can just drink vodka starting from 7 years old. And
oh, wow.
They do.
So which one were you?
Yes, and so it just came naturally from my childhood. I was finding friends in the books, so I don't think, I changed a lot.
Who are you reading these days that is really making an impact on you?
I was just reading The Economist. I mean, I don't really... You know why? Because I want to, it's not the most obvious choice, I guess, for a progressive activist, for an anarchist. But I found out that it's really useful to know the agenda of people with who you don't agree with. And I actually was learning English, like, I was advancing my English on reading The Economist. I was reading every issue. And it said to me a lot. At some point, I saw an Economist issue dedicated to prison industrial complex in America. It was towards the second term of Barack Obama. And that, at the time, I understood that there is a possibility that something may change. Because they're pretty conservative. They're liberal conservatives. So if they start to write about it, then... but unfortunately, Trump came to power, and
Mm-hmm. Right. And now we have more and more detention centers being built, and at great private profit. This might be a good time to talk a little bit about the work that that you've done on prisons. After your release from prison, you founded not one but two organizations that were dedicated to prison reform and human rights related to incarceration. Can you talk about those and the work that they've done?
Sure. It's my pleasure. When we were in prison, me and my comrade Masha Lekhina, we were exchanging letters while we were in prison, and we were thinking that it will be really good to continue our work on prisons when we will be out, because Masha started this work when she ended up in penal colony. She understood that prisoners around here don't have enough warm clothes, and it was winter was coming, and they were in cardboard shoes, and it's really like thin jackets in Ural winter, which is like minus 30 degrees Celsius. And she started to cause a descent in penal colony, and so they moved her to solitary confinement. But she continued, and she would sue their penal colony while she was in penal colony, and I thought it's just so badass, and I decided to continue her work because, you know, I have to give her credit for that. She started it because I was so scared. I was so scared when I ended up in my penal colony, where you have to work for 16 hours a day when you don't have day offs. Everybody screams at each other. It's hellish atmosphere. On the way there, I didn't believe that it can. There may be a place on earth where everything is so bad. As before, in pretrial detention, it is pretty bad, but you're just sitting around in your cell with no access to medicine, which is bad, but good side is your time is your time. Mm-hmm. And you can read. And I didn't have any other books rather than Bible because they didn't let me to have any other books. I was asking for Zizek and Foucault and Russian dissidents, but they let me read just Bible. So at the time... At the time of our process, at court trial, I was quoting Bible much better than the other side, who was accusing us of going against religion. I was like, yeah, but, you know, like Mark 1, number 117, I forgot almost all, but at the time I was just like, anyway... but when they move you to penal colony, it starts to be really nasty because you don't own your own time, you don't own your body anymore. And they put me in front of this sewing machine where I had to do police uniforms. And this kind of a psychological torture because you're making clothes for those people who put you in jail and who are torturing you. And I was scared. And after 1 month, a Human Rights Commission came to my colony and we didn't sleep for a week before that, because like that's the thing about this so-called checks, or how they like when they come to check what's going on in penal colony, a penal colony tries to portray like everything is really good. So we were painting, we were cutting the grass. It was winter, so our prison warden said, you have to turn the winter into summer. You have to get rid of all the snow. And it's your problem how you're going to do it. Oh my goodness. So you have to get rid of all the snow and you have to melt the ice and you have to ask your relatives to send you salt, and then you, with the salt you start to melt the ice. So we didn't sleep. We were doing this kind of stupid job. And when human rights activists came, I was just pale and lifeless, and I was like shadow, and I couldn't find any courage in myself to speak up. I just said I like everything. I think it's a really good place, and I think they treat me well, because I was scared what they will do with me and what they will do with the rest of us, and that's how prison system in Russia works. But then Masha sparked the resistance inside the prison, and later in the year, I found a missile courage through other prisoners who would come to me and just complain about their personal... They would tell me their personal stories, like a woman who didn't have access to therapy, and she has HIV, and she knows that she will die there if she will not get access to right HIV therapy. Another woman who didn't have access to her relatives, though she's, we do have this right to communicate with our relatives, mm-hmm. And many other stories like that. And they told me that I'm the only one person who can save them. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, why? And their reasoning was pretty clear and rational, because I was the one person who had lawyers and access to media.
You're listening to Russian conceptual artist, political activist, and founder of the art collective Pussy Riot, Nadia Tolokonikova, whose new book is Read and Riot, A Pussy Riot Guide to Activism. She's joined in conversation by Sarah Marcus on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
There really sad story about women in Russian prisons that for some reason they are much less supported than men in Russian prisons. Because Russian women, they tend to stay with their husbands even when they are in prison, but it doesn't work other way around. Husband will leave the woman if she will find herself in prison. So sometimes her parents, if they're still alive, can support her, but just little, like maybe 10% of women, they get some support from the outside. And the reason why they end up in prison, they're ridiculous. It is our war on drugs, because we have our own war on drugs. And you can end up in prison just because you have like a few grams of weed in the pocket. Or domestic violence, because we don't have any specific law against domestic violence. And Russian police don't think that domestic violence actually is something that you you should consider seriously. So when a woman calls to the police and say, like, I'm about to be beaten, or I was beaten, they're saying, oh, you should call us when you will be killed. And then we will come to you and we investigate a murder. Because that's something that we may be interested in.
Oh, my goodness.
And there is a case that happened recently. It became really big and popular because conversation with this woman was recorded. And, I mean, there are many, many cases that just not registered, that they're not recorded. So that's why we can take a look at them. They're not that shocking. It's like, you know, when a policeman kills somebody and somebody's making video of it, it's just the same sad story. So she calls the police and she's telling, I was beaten and please come here because I'm about to get killed because he will kill me. And the woman, policewoman on the phone, she's like, oh, everything will be fine. It'll be fine. He's okay. He's all right. And after half an hour, she is killed. And yeah. So women end up in prisons because they decided to defend themselves.
Right.
They hurt people who beat them for dozens of years. And yeah. So after I heard all these stories, I decided to go on hunger strike, and I started a hunger strike with demands to make prison work day shorter, from 16 hours a day to 8 hours a day, and to give prisoners real right to complain about what's going on in prison without fear to be punished for that. I know it's quite idealistic, but it was my demand. Thank you. After that, I was transported. Like they were quite scared of this hunger strike. I was transported from Central Russia to Siberia. And for 1 month, nobody heard of me, and my relatives, some media, my lawyers, they didn't know where I am, if I'm still alive. But it was actually interesting time for me, because what I learned from that is that you should show teeth to the system that wants to oppress you. You should be loud, you should be angry, you should protest, because before, prison system treated me just... I know the prison really terribly, because I didn't show my anger. That's why they thought that I'm weak. I was thinking that I will not be angry, and that's my power. in not getting angry. But the thing is, like, when somebody has power over you, they will not listen. They will not look at your, oh, yeah, I'm proud, and I'm proud, and I'm calm. It just didn't work. It didn't work. So at the point when I started to actively resist, they started to respect me. And they would even do ridiculous things like buy food, like order food from the restaurant and bring to me while I was still in prison, because they were scared that I will write a complaint about their prison. So in Siberia at some point, like for the last 2 months, I found myself just lying on the bed and I was reading Victor Hugo, and I was around food like grapes and melons. I was like, I want paints, and I want to make a giant picture. And so the next day I will have everything like from store with crafts, because they were really scared that I will start to complain about them. Like, but that's the position where you want them to be,
right? Because people were actually paying attention to what you said, and you were able to draw attention to the conditions there. And that was a power that you had from the moment that you became incarcerated, but that you only began to use when you stopped trying to follow the rules.
Yeah. That's a big problem. Like, I think it's deep inside us to that thing that I should follow the rules. Uh-huh. And even I was a punk when I was arrested. I was thinking about myself as a rebel, but still, it's deeply inside us. Like, I should be a good girl. And when, you know, the big man, prison warden tells you, like, you're behaving bad. I'm like, yeah, I'm good girl, I'm following the law. And you don't realize at that point that actually they use law to oppress you, and you shouldn't care that much about their law in this instance, when it's just, it's just magic stick that they use to kill you, basically.
I mean, you mentioned anger, and there anger's a lot in the public discussion about politics right now, and specifically around feminism. And there's anger that's coming up, but then it's also being used against feminists by saying, "Oh, there's angry mobs, and we're gonna, you know, thanks so much for coming out and being this angry mob, and now we're gonna use this to the right wing is saying, you know, this is the best thing the Democrats have handed us, this fantastic tool to." Like, to win in the midterms, because the feminists are being this angry mob, and nobody likes that. And I guess we'll find out in a couple of weeks how true that is, or whether it's just another attempt to sort of like shame us back into not being angry. But I've been thinking about this anger thing, and I'm curious about it because, expressing anger can, as the story you just told us, like, get you things and get you make people take you seriously as someone to be reckoned with, and at the same time, there's a I keep wondering, like, but isn't there a way in which being consumed by anger sort of also shuts you down or burns you out from the inside? And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what your experience of anger has been.
Okay. So you should cook your anger in the right way. Because, I mean, coming back to that story, it wasn't just anger. It was anger plus organizing, plus, like, activist and political organizing, plus structuring, let's say preparing infrastructure for this anger to be understood and to be articulated. And it's really important to make this public relation effort when you're angry. You kind of just scream. So it's always like you want to be heard, you want to be understood, but at the same time you want to express emotions. So it's like, it's a mixture. It's an activist salad. So we had to made an agreement with my fellow activist Petr Brzilov that he will come to me for 3 days in a row as kind of a lawyer. He's not exactly a lawyer, but there is a law that he's a public defender. He can come to me and discuss law with me. In fact, we didn't discuss law. I was writing this open letter for 3 days in a row, and I collected all information, that every single detail that I noticed during my 1 year in that place, and stories that I've heard, names and all little details that could be interesting for investigators outside, for journalists outside, for activists. And at the same time, this activist camp was prepared to be in action. And at the same time, we organized like something like small group of action inside prison. Uh-huh. Me and my friends who supported me, though it was really dangerous for them. It was strictly prohibited for people to support me inside the prison. Mm-hmm. And some of them lost their ability to get parole.
Oh, wow.
And they had to stay for a couple of more years in prison because they were just friends with me. And we made an agreement with my close friend of mine in prison that if she will know that I'm beaten while I'm on hunger strike, she'll start a hunger strike too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was organized in a really good way. So then prison wardens who knew, who discovered later about this like long process of organizing, they started to use it against me because they told me that it was brought from somewhere from outside and I was actually a victim of this plan. Mm-hmm. So somebody said me that I have to do this and this and this. Somebody supposedly paid me for that because they couldn't believe that I could organize it from inside.
Wow, that's so similar to what's being said now about activists, that they're paid protesters and they've been put up to it by someone, because it's just too much to imagine that people of their own accord would want to take a stand and speak out. Or that maybe even, like, it's not so much to imagine, but that you have to, that people want to destroy that idea. Like, they need to tamp down the notion that somebody was pissed off enough to say something. And so they put out the story that, like, you know, that you were put up to it or that we were put up to it.
But who pays protesters in your country?
Well, I mean, it's not a real thing.
I know, but Hillary Clinton pays us.
Pays you.
I mean, that's what they say.
That's where that beautiful blouse came from.
Huh. Hillary Clinton, CIA, what else?
Probably George Soros, right?
George Soros, of course. That Trump Make America Great Again video was paid by Hillary Clinton campaign. And I'm like, yeah, it was paid, but like, it's just personal funds of Ricky Reed, the producer of the song. No, he got it from Hillary Clinton. I was, of course, yes. I wish. Yeah. Not really. But yeah, seriously, who? Because for Russians, it's always Americans who you...
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, so
you,
like,
blame Americans.
So, like, what's the...
What's the source?
Right, what's the imagined
source? Who pays
the
protesters?
I actually don't know who they're saying does it. I haven't seen that. Does anyone know who the story is? Soros.
Uh-huh. Soros?
George Soros. Soros!
How much money does he have?
Yeah, wow. So it makes a lot of sense. I mean, it would be a silly question to say, why were you engaged in activism for the treatment of prisoners while you were incarcerated? That's a duh. But following getting out, what is it about the issue of prisons that makes it so important to continue to work on for you now?
I think firstly it's just personal psychotherapy, because you just don't want to admit that you wasted 2 years of your life. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying to myself that, okay, I got this experience, I got it for something, and it's not just wasted years. It means that I was given this experience to make something, to change something for the better. And as far as I know, Masha's thought process was pretty much the same. So at the moment when we were released from jail, we decided to start an NGO that's called Zona Prawa. It's like Zone of Justice. And we decided that Zone, which is a name for penal colony in Russian, Zona. Zone will be an umbrella term for what we're doing since now. Zone of Justice, it's an NGO that helps prisoners. And Media Zona, it's a website, it's a media outlet that covers prisons, police departments, and human rights abuses in those places. It was like, coming back to our previous question, it was something like another, completely another experience of being almost a manager, because before we were artists and punks, and it was a lot of organizing work too, but I would say it was more about anger. But when we were released from prison, we understood that actually we have such a big impact and voice and yes, access to resources. No, seriously, okay, let's say we go to Roskilde Festival or Glastonbury, they want to pay us some money, and we use this money to start this website to pay lawyers who help prisoners. And it all requires some work. It was exciting. It was like a lot of embarrassing moments when we understood that we are not CEOs, but at this point we learned how to do it. And we built this Zona Prawa we took as the model ACLU. Because we love ACLU. Yay. And we think it's a real deal organization, because you know, like most of NGOs and all these organizations that spread awareness and just talk too much, they are useless. And like this business of non-governmental organizations is really hypocritical and terrible. So most of them I don't really like, but I really love ACLU, and that's why it's Zona Prawa we made it with Pavel Chikov, who is a great human rights lawyer in Russian, and he studied how ACLU works here in America. So basically just a bunch of lawyers, really great, or lawyers who help case by case to people who are in terrible situation in prison. Mm-hmm. Mostly those people who are terminally ill or just seriously ill, and we're helping them to get medication. And we're helping them to file cases to Russian courts and to European Court of Human Rights, which has been really helpful, because we managed to release like 2, sometimes 3 dozens of prisoners a year, which is for Russian prison system is a good result. Yeah. Thank you. But at some point we understood that there is no media outlet that can actually write about all this stuff, because it was 2014, it was really terrible time for independent press in Russia, because it was a time of war with Ukraine and annexation of Crimea, and Putin got really crazy. I mean, he wasn't really sane before, but at the time he closed a number of independent medias, and so we understood, okay, we have to do it. I mean, not like we, like our community. I don't mean me personally. Uh-huh. It's just, I'm talking for like at least 3 dozens of people. It was growing. It's growing since 2014, and we're really thankful to all people who are reading us, because at some point, like a year ago, we reached 1 million unique visitors a month, which is okay for independent activists, free of censorship media outlet. And we started to cover another topics, not just prisons and the police departments, but prosecutions of political activists, and which is important for us, protests all around Russia, because usually what media write about. They write about protests in Moscow and St. Petersburg, and maybe two or three big cities. But what is, like, you know, you know the change is coming when you see that people, even in small provincial cities, even in countryside, they start to question, like, whether our power is corrupted or not. And they started doing it. And miners, school teachers, labor unions, it all happening. And you don't hear about it a lot, but yeah, we're trying to make a list. And every day we're monitoring what's going on.
Mm. That's fantastic.
Yeah,
thank you.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is Russian conceptual artist, political activist, and founder of the art collective Pussy Riot, Nadia Tolokonikova, whose new book is Read and Riot, A Pussy Riot Guide to Activism. She's joined in conversation by Sarah Marcus. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So on the one hand, you're involved with these NGOs that you started, and on the other hand, you continue to make art and make music. Are these, how do you see the connection between these two zones of action in your life?
Zones.
You see, you've got it in me now, yeah.
I never separated. And when I was like 16 or 17, I always replied on the question, like, what is more important, art or politics? I was like, it's the same for me, art and politics. They're equal, and I think I'm just trying to be truthful, at least to myself, mm-hmm. and maintaining both spheres in my life. And they're interconnected, so we're inspired by Miria Zana and Zana Prava in our work in art. Like, let's say the music video about prosecutor of Russian Federation Yuri Chaika, who is known. He's supposed to go after all the criminals in Russia, but it turned out at some point that he's the main criminal because he killed people in order to get their property and in order to get their factories and give it away to his sons. And so we were writing about it in Media Zona, and then I was just was emotionally hurt by these stories, and I decided to make this Chaika music video where people are being tortured by us in prosecutors' uniforms.
Right. So that video is made under the name Pussy Riot, as are several others, many others that we can see online, including Make America Great Again, as you mentioned. But who or what is Pussy Riot now? Who's in it, or is it a flowing concept? Is anybody a Pussy Riot? Is there a collective?
Is there anybody in Pussy Riot? No, it's like the really Wittgenstein's thing. Like, you know, like it's not. There is no one definition of Pussy Riot. Like, you can. It's like really family resemblance thing. And you can start your own Pussy Riot, and you can start your own Pussy Riot, and then nobody really in control of it. But just historically, people who are motivated the most of doing something under the name of Pussy Riot are people who were in the beginning of this group. Like, I would be really happy if somebody else would come and be like really active under the name of Pussy Riot right now. But for some reason, it happens that like me, Masha Alekhina, and Peter Rizilov, who were in the roots of Pussy Riot, they are making like the most, I don't know, visible projects. But at the same time, you know, sometimes like other Pussy Riot members, we could come to country, and then we'd been approached by a group of people, mostly women, and they say, like, oh, we started a branch of Pussy Riot in our town. Mm-hmm. And it's fantastic. It was their goal from the very beginning. We wanted to create a movement. That's why we didn't want to show our faces. Right. And eventually our faces were opened when we ended up in court, because mm-hmm. it's really hard to keep masks when you're in court, because they just take it away from you.
Right.
And it was actually the biggest problem for me at, you know, the first 2 weeks of my arrest, because I was thinking not that much about myself, but about that our identity was revealed. Because I didn't believe actually that this for a long time. I thought like maybe we'll spend in prison like for 1 month, and mm-hmm. so my biggest concern was identity. And we were imagining bright new future with lots of hundreds of women in different cities all around Russia in these colorful masks.
Mm-hmm. And so. Is part of what you're saying that you think that that got a little bit that it became harder for that to actually come about because at this crucial moment in the history of the group, suddenly these three members were, instead of like, it could be anybody, it could be you, you don't know who this is, it was like, oh, actually, it's Nadia
mm-hmm.
and Masha, and that sort yeah. of put a break on the possible like proliferation of masked Pussy Riot squads?
It didn't. It actually caused, I mean, probably you saw some of them. I was in prison. I was just getting photos from cities, including American cities, of activists who called themselves Pussy Riot and dancing in these beanies. And so it happened, but obviously their nature of it changed when our identities were revealed, definitely. And we never wanted to reveal it, and as a matter of fact, we wanted to end our personal involvement in this project like in a year, so the life of this project shouldn't be longer than a year. Mm-hmm. And then we had to be in prison for 2 years, and I couldn't say, like, oh, I'm not Pussy Riot anymore. It would sound like me trying to, like, me being weak or trying to escape from what I've done, which wasn't exactly the point. So we kept saying that we are Pussy Riot. And when we got out of jail, I was trying to do it again. I was like, no, actually, like, since it's my face, I'm not Pussy Riot anymore. So they started to call me and Masha ex-Pussy Riot, which was even worse. like, you know, you can be an ex-Spice Girls or something, but it's just like... it's so cheesy and so terrible and something from, like, entertainment mainstream industry. So we decided, like, we will be Pussy Riot.
Okay.
So now it's just part of our names, like, more like our surname.
Uh-huh. What's next for you artistically, creatively? This book has come out. Are there more videos, more songs in the works? Are you eyeing a completely other direction?
We want to work more on music, and I'm really looking forward to November when we're planning to start it. Like, we're thinking constantly about new things, but not always have time for it, because mm-hmm. you know, recently we were really busy trying to save Peter's life, and we didn't think that much about art. But since Peter is healthy, I mean almost healthy now, he went for. We got really great news from Berlin. Peter is still in Berlin, and he was treated where
he was.
For anyone
in the audience who might not have been following this step by step, can you take them from the beginning?
So Peter Verzilov, who is a member of Pussy Riot, he was poisoned 1 month ago, and it happened in Moscow. And so he was unconscious for 3 days. Then we moved him from Moscow to Berlin on the fifth day of his poisoning, and he was delirious for 2 weeks. He couldn't recognize his mom from the beginning, and then he started to getting back to us slowly, and it was pretty scary. But after 1 month, Peter is getting better. For the first time in the months, he went for jogging.
I'm so yeah, glad to hear that he's doing better.
He's doing better, and now we can finally think about art with him.
You end your book with a reflection on love, on the importance of love in art and in activism, and you bring in bell hooks and Nina Simone, and you write, "There are no successful mass people's movements without sincere, dangerous commitment to loving those around you." And so I just wanted to invite you to reflect for us. We spoke about anger earlier, and also anger within the context of organizing. But what is love good for?
I don't know. I guess for helping each other, and for things like hiring a private medical plane and bringing somebody from Moscow to Berlin. You know, that's like that's in particular. But and by the way, love is good for people who are. We had to find $40,000 in 2 hours, and we found them not from George Soros, but like from people who we know, who somehow collected. Like, it was giant effort. So I think that's how they shared their active love, but not just that. It is, I like that you brought up anger issue with love. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of our conversation with Marina Abramovic.
Yeah.
And she's all about love recently, because she, like, all her artistic career, she was more about strength and willpower, and about like finding a really great concept and making sure that you will do whatever you can to make this concept right. But now we talked about her. She started to focus more on the importance of love. She's like, yeah, we have to be super focused and powerful, but you know, while you're fighting, it's so easy to just forget about love, forget about your emotions, forget about yourself as a human being, forget about taking care of yourself, and forget about taking care of people around you, mm-hmm. and just becoming emotion, like, I don't know, a warrior who doesn't have any emotions left, right. Burned out, right?
Yeah,
that's the right word.
Yeah.
And I felt it, I was suffering from it really badly after prison, because I was fighting so hard, and prison was really hard for me. I was talking to a lot of my friends who went through prison, and it wasn't that hard for everybody, but for some reason, just for me personally, it was really hard. And I didn't want to admit it, because I was thinking about myself as the strongest person on earth. Right. And when you don't want to admit it, that's the problem. So you cannot work on this trauma. And for, I think, 2014, 2015, 16, 17, I think I just started to work on this in this year. I started to try to warm myself a little bit, because you know, otherwise you're trying to pretend, you're pretending to be a hero, mm-hmm. but you're missing a lot in life, because you don't feel, you make yourself a statue uh-huh. that doesn't have any real connections in life,
right.
So yeah, you want to be a hero, but at the same time you want to be vulnerable, and that's mm-hmm. Dichotomy.
Yeah, and you have to find a balance that lets you sustain over the long term, because you know, what you've known for a long time, and what I think we in this country are learning now, is that it's not a short fight. It's not just like put on the push until the midterms and then you can relax, or put on the push until re-election, then you can relax. It's going to go on for a long time. You were asking me, like, what's the significance of what just happened with the Supreme Court? It's that I think, personally, and people here can have different feelings, I think in a way it's that the time scale just got so long. Mm. Like, we don't anymore have a sense of, like, around this next corner maybe there's relief. We have to figure out how to stay awake and grounded and connected and alive for the long haul. And those are questions that, you know, Americans were very optimistic and, like, our success is always, like, tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if it's not tomorrow morning, then it's the next morning. And it's really, it's a big sea change for us, I think, to try and figure out how to suddenly have this event horizon that it might be in the decades and how to sustain. And I think that you're talking about what you've learned from that and from facing similar kinds of temporalities.
I was talking with Lawrence O'Donnell after our chat on MSNBC in the studio. He wrote a book about protests around 1968. And we were talking about the importance of this long-term fight and readiness for it. And he says he even remembers that spirit. I don't know how old he was, but he says he remembers. So it is pretty different from what we have now in America. That's what he said to me, because at the time of anti-war protests, people didn't expect to win. They expect to be disappointed. They expected to lose. But still, they wanted to continue, and they were ready to continue just because they were thinking that it's morally right. But they didn't expect that it would immediately bring them some results. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the trap for activists, when you think that you will immediately get some results, because activism is not, you know, is not a store, is not a cure. You're just swiping card, and then if you pay good enough money, then you get something. You get one right, two right for $2, for $3. It's like really different. No, sometimes you can get everything for nothing, right? And sometimes you can work for decades and get nothing. But it's just, that's why I think Bernie Sanders is really important, and he's changed, he changed perception, at least he changed my perception of modern politics. He brought it back to the moral values. Like, he made politics ethic-centered again. So it makes you, it allows you to work to get this your ethical ideals, knowing that maybe you will not see them in your life at all. Mm-hmm. So it's more like coming back to Kant. Immanuel Kant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the categorical imperative.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So. Thank you so much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Russian conceptual artist, political activist, and founder of the art collective Pussy Riot, Nadia Tolokonikova, whose new book is Read and Riot, A Pussy Riot Guide to Activism. She was joined in conversation by writer and musician Sarah Marcus. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Dan Folds, and Alex Espalet. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pamantuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.